You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I am your host, Lance White. Tonight, my guest is John Hoag. John returns to share his wisdom and insight, and he will be sharing his latest prophecies and predictions for 2011. John has received international recognition, appearing on over 100 television and 700 radio shows, no doubt more than that by now, on three continents. Describing himself as a rogue scholar, his pursuit of inner wisdom, combined with intense research on Nostradamus' quatrains, coupled with deep spiritual digging, has given him unique insight into the human being and our near future. His website is www.hoagprophecy.com, and it empowers us to awaken to our inner selves, fully present, while observing the play of life. Tonight, we'll be talking about his latest ebook, Predictions for 2011. So, without further ado, let's welcome John back to the show now. Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Lance. I just came up from my little village here in the, just 40 minutes north of Seattle. There was a gallery crawl going on, and I got to watch a couple of belly dancers be posing as a bunch of people sketched them and did oils and watercolors. And my wow. My crazy little town is exactly the place for me. I fit right in.
Wow. Kind of quirky and interesting.
Well, I kind of call it, it's the only town I've been in where the sense of community reminds me somewhat like a shadow of what I used to experience when I lived in Rajneeshpuram, when I lived in a commune of 20,000 people in the eastern Oregon desert. Wow. It has that kind of sense of community. There's three theaters here, thespian theaters, a children's theater. We have an orchestra. A lot of Hollywood expatriates, including one of my friends who was the little girl who was the autograph hound, hounding Jack Benny on the Jack Benny Show and playing violin.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, she's up here.
Jeez. She's
we have a few Academy Award winners up here.
Oh, which one?
I think it was somebody for sound about 3 years ago. Somebody got a Best Sound. I don't know him that well. I see him pass through town. But, you know, we have that. We had one of the French hornsmen of the L.A. Philharmonic and a lot of retired L.A. Philharmonic orchestral people. And it's interesting. And I also was born in Hollywood, California. So I always felt like a changeling living in L.A. It always felt like I belonged up here, and I eventually got up here after a few detours to India and around the world, Australia and Bangkok and a few other places.
Wow. Well, you know, we both had experiences in with groups where you get to live on the site, you know, with a spiritual teacher, and Rajneesh is one of my all-time favorites. It seems as if these groups are really seeds of the future, that they really are ways of being and ways of living that we can take back into the world and help to create. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, because one of the things that I've been doing since I started writing books about 17 books ago, the last seven being e-books and the others since then, before then, were all made of dead trees. I'm trying to lower my carbon footprint, and hopefully my readers will lower theirs too by reading books on photons and electrons, you know.
Right, I agree.
I have, in the study of prophecy, realized that, you know, there's two definitions of prophecy. Prophecy is the more kind of mundane interpretation of the word is making predictions, forecasting the future. But the deeper, more significant, esoteric meaning of prophecy is divine inspiration. It's enlightenment. It's awakening to the truth, a revelation. And so in that, if one goes deep enough into the study of prophecy like I have, one has to plumb the deeper sense of that. And so I started in my early 20s after having a spiritual satori or a glimpse of something kind of amazing that totally altered my life. That's when you know you've really had a spiritual experience. If you've really had a very powerful spiritual experience and it hasn't just been another masturbation of the mind in the name of spiritualism, it will change your life.
It'll
physically change you. It'll change who you're around, what you're doing. And that's a good indicator that it was for real. So I went off and I started studying. Since I saw the future as being so dire, I wanted to see if there was an alternative to it. And that's where I got into the deeper understanding of prophecy, which is about bringing a divine inspiration into the world. And one of the key people in my life, the key person in my life who I met in 1980 and sat before him, and he actually initiated me into neo-sannyas, was Osho, or he was known then, Bhagwan, and he I also came to understand that something that I think the future will understand, that he was one of the significant teachers of our time, and he was also a prophet of the new humanity.
Absolutely.
And I hope to write a 3-book series, which will be part autobiographical and part what I usually do, studying the bigger picture of prophecy and collective examinations of prophecy, as a way to, because, you know, I am not just a person on the riverbank being a scholar about water. I jump in. It's just like somebody who says that they're an expert on love and they can be objective about love because they've never loved anybody. You know, and there are certain subjective mysteries that you have to be a part of to really understand. Anybody who's really loved would laugh at anybody who had that kind of stance. Well, anyone who's really jumped into the mystery of being with a real master, a spiritual teacher, a person like a Gurdjieff or an Osho, you have to take the risk, and it is a real, you know, not this kind of supermarket spiritualism, which is more kind of distraction, entertainment in the name of, you know, therapy groups, The Secret, The Power of Now,
creating your reality.
These things are, if they don't really upset your apple cart of ego, then they're BS.
Yep.
And in the name of something very spiritual. But when you're with real teachers, it takes guts because, it's two things. It takes guts for two reasons. You become exposed to yourself. If you're in a spiritual community of a master, everybody that's there is kind of bouncing off each other's ego trips. So they get exposed in the climate of the Buddha field of the master. The other thing is that you get a is a subtler fear, the fear of joy, the fear of bliss and ecstasy. When you go through the stuff where you peel off the sloughed dead skin of your ego and then you discover what is underneath, there's a whole universe that's an eternal process after that, the eternity of now, that you tap into. And it's shattering as well. It's like a spiritual orgasm. In fact, it is the higher. Osho used to talk about, and he had a very controversial book. He spoke in India about it, and it was at a time when India was very uptight about sexuality in the late 60s. And his book, his lecture series was called From Sex to Superconsciousness. And, you know, he's always been often called by the stupid press, who only seem to read the if all of our history of the great masters was based on police reports and studies of angry disciples who didn't get their projections fulfilled like Judas, or, you know, I bet you if you only had Judas as your source of Jesus Christ, it wouldn't be a very good story. He would be a cult guru, and against the traditions and a threat. Well, Osho was called the sex guru by a lot of people because but if you actually knew him, if you actually sat before him, if you lived in his communities, you discovered that in a subtle way, he was sex's greatest enemy. He understood that the best way to get beyond one's biological issues is to go through them with awareness. And so he said, sex is a good beginning, but don't stop there. Mm-hmm. You have to keep going. Mm-hmm. You have to, because the whole point is super consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And sex is the very lowest beginning part.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of people who do these tantric groups that are really just another name for a swing party.
Right.
You know, which is okay. I'm not up for or against that. But when they call it tantric spiritual, it's a swing party with a spiritual glean. But you know what I learned from Osho's path, which for me was very tantric. Although Osho was many multi dimensions, he was in. It depended if you came in. He spoke on all the traditions: the Jewish, the Arab, the Sufi, the Buddhist, the Hindu, and it all was in morning talk sessions lasting about 2.5 hours, sometimes morning and evening, that ended up being almost 800 books worth of information.
And I have quite a few of those in there.
Yeah, do you have Yoga Alpha Omega Volume 1?
Yes, I do.
You are lucky, because Volume 1 and Volume 3 are almost impossible to get. I must have gotten the last two copies on the planet.
Well, there was an old bookstore on in the Haight Ashbury in San Francisco, and they were they had gotten a huge load of Osho books from the ashram, and a lot of them were first editions and the rare ones. And I bought as many as I could that were interesting to me, but you know, I didn't know shit from Shinola. So, but you know, what impressed me was that he could just turn on a dime and talk about any tradition, and to me that's a indication of a master.
Well, he was also unique in that he was before his enlightenment, he basically came from being a teacher. You know, he was a professor of philosophy in Jabalpur University, and then he claims to have gotten enlightened at a very young age of 21, said that was also kind of difficult, because if you get enlightened before the age of 35, when you're still kind of in the upward climb of your biology, it's really hard on the vehicle.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, he died at 59. Of course, he was poisoned by thallium heavy poisoning when he was arrested without a warrant in Charlotte. You know, this is another thing to get into. You know, you've got somebody who may be a real master when they upset a lot of people.
Oh, yes.
You know, everybody that Oprah Winfrey embraces is not a master. If they're cuddly and I love you, you love me. You know, if they're Barney the purple dinosaur nice to you, you're not dealing with a real master. Because if you study the history of masters, they are always called cult gurus, threatening the youth. Why did they poison Socrates? For the same things they were hurling at Osho, they were hurling at Socrates 2,500 years before. Yeah. Buddha was poisoned.
I did not know.
In the West, it's not that well known. There's a lot of information about Buddha that is not carried over because of Western bias, but he was actually poisoned by Devadatta, his half-brother, who was very much jealous of what he was doing and tried 8 times to kill him and finally killed him by dropping some doo-doo in his bowl of rice, and he died at 84 of extreme dysentery from being poisoned by bad food.
Well, of course, then you have the paradox that the master knows his moment of death.
Yes, that's true. I saw that with Osho. It's quite remarkable. There are stories about it. He started getting very transparent. It's about 6 months before a real master dies, he knows. And one of the interesting things, Osho is very subtle about that. I know his dentist, David Geet, who's hopefully someday going to publish his amazing book on his life with Osho, OSHA used to, OSHA was always teaching, even when he was getting his teeth fixed. He would, right in the middle of it, masters can be kind of funny, right in the middle of having this machine drilling in it, he'd suddenly start talking, and poor David Gate would pull it out and go, oh, no, you know, and kind of get David Gate panicking, and he said, now, calm down, you know. he was talking about how I feel ohm in my forehead. And he would just suddenly start talking like that. Yes, yes, OSHA, that sounds very nice. Now open your mouth. He said, oh, I want to tell you, I feel ohm in my forehead. Oh, that's okay, OSHA, that's really great. It's interesting. He said, no, you can feel it too. Put your finger on my third eye between my brow. And I asked him, what do you feel? And he said, yeah, I felt a pulse, an interesting pulse.
Wow.
And then he just, matter of fact, OSHA said, when ohm descends into my hara, into my belly center, then I'll have 6 months to live.
Oh.
And so, yes, OSHA, of course, panicking David Gate. He's always got him panicking, so you could look at his panic. And, you know, 6 months later, well, no, several months later, it was August 1989, I guess it was, and he suddenly, out of the blue, almost like continuing the conversation that David Gate had completely forgotten, said, ohm is in my belly, is in my heart now. Oh, that's nice, OSHA. Very nice. And, you know, and then it was later when he realized that that was like OSHA's subtle way of saying the countdown has started.
Wow.
You know, so.
Wow.
But he died. I had the honor of, I was one of his guards in his household final days. Well, the final few years. And I used to, a lot of my books came to me sitting under his almond tree under the Indian moonlight in his garden with him just a wall away sleeping. But I could often hear him playing this beautiful, he had an incredible sense of classical Indian music. And I also saw his favorite film, Baju Barwa, I can't even say it, but it's about a famous musician that lived in the times of Akbar's court, when Tansen was the court musician, and they were two great singer sitar players. And so he also, OSHA was an accomplished modern artist, quite remarkable stuff. And he used to draw, he used to take his watercolors and dip them down into the four pages of his books. He had a library of like 100,000 books, which he had a photographic memory. He could read a page in a second. He used to go through 70 books a week.
Wow.
And he'd retain them. And that's one of the reasons why he could talk on everything. He said, I understand the Western mind, he used to say, because I've read everything you've written. You know? And then when we got less literate and we started getting into our video TV scenes, he started watching movies by the hundreds.
Oh, yeah.
To see what we were watching in our visual lives. But anyway, I was a guard in his household, and I remember when he left his body, it was really remarkable because I was one of the guards that escorted the other guards who were carrying him down to the Burning Ghats. And these Burning Ghats happened to be a place back in 1980 when I first came to Pune. I lived next to the Burning Ghats, which is where people of all castes come to be burnt, Buddhists, Hindus. The Muslims had their own graveyards, which were kind of interesting in Pune because a lot of the bones were sticking out of the ground. It was kind of interesting. That was next door. But I, like a good double Scorpio, I happened to be living next to the Burning Ghats. And so there I am in my orange robe and mala and sannyas clothing, and I used to walk down. When the tinkling bells were happening, it meant somebody was coming in to be burnt. And so I walked in, and I used to sit in front of the burning bodies and observe the destruction of the human body.
Wow.
And then the next night, I would meditate on the skull and the bones left from the fire. And the third night, I would sit and meditate on the empty, washed-out pit.
Wow.
One of those pits, 10 years later, my own master was laid down into it, I was guarding him for 3 nights, mainly to protect the people who would think they could reach into the coals and pull out some vibhuti or holy ash or something, because it was actually white hot. They would burn themselves severely, so we were there more to protect the people from doing that. And So the day that he was that it was the third morning, the family came. They poured water into the ash, and I always wondered how you could separate wood ash from person ash. And what happens is when it's wet, wood ash is brown, and person ash is white.
Yeah.
You can see the outline of Osho in there, the melted pearls on his hat. You know, I could see his bones, which were all iridescent, all laid out quite neatly, and it's an amazing ritual in India. It really helps in compassion. It's hard, but it helps people understand how you know, you're walking, talking one moment, and then you die, and then 3 days later, your beloveds are reaching into the gooey ash and pulling out your bones, crushing them, and putting them in an urn. It really brings home the feeling of how you're not the body.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's interesting because we'll have to talk about this some other time, but you know, I've had a lot of extensive work with hauntings, ghosts, and exorcisms and stuff like that. What I've noticed is that in India, especially in the non-Muslim areas of India, you do not have a lot of hauntings because the Indian practice of open air, burning the body, the spirit sees it happening and lets go.
Yeah.
But look at our places where we hide death and throw it under the ground, under the rug, as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. You've got a lot of hauntings.
Yeah, yeah.
People don't know they're dead.
Right. And then, of course, I've heard that people who die suddenly in car accidents or 911 type things, that they don't realize that they're just, it happens so quickly that the spirit just remains. And that's the same situation.
Well, I was in one. I have had three brushes with death, two which were sudden. And the most sudden, I had a premonition. I had just come back from India, and I was walking in San Pedro out of my door. I was going to meet my girlfriend who was in Laguna Beach.
Uh-huh.
And I had to drive through Long Beach to get to them in L.A. And so just as I'm getting to the door, I'm feeling this incredible presence over me, like I'm going to be squashed like an ant by a giant is so big I can't even see it. And it was this ominous feeling. And then I was tearing at the door, and a friend of mine said, well, what's the matter? I said, I don't think I'm supposed to go. Maybe I shouldn't go driving or something. It's just like I feel like I'm going to die.
Uh-huh.
And then I just shrugged off. Something pushed me through the door, like an invisible hand pushed me through the door. So I went, got in my little two-door green Maverick. 20 minutes later, an illegal alien without a license in his brother's car, which was a huge station wagon, creamed through a red light at 55 miles an hour and hit me in the door of my car.
Wow.
And they gave me up for dead. I know because somebody watched the whole thing and was the person who called some guy from Ohio. And he was a tourist seeing Long Beach. And there was a pool of gas. And I was white. My neck looked like it was broken. Of course, I was very limber then. So they thought, and they couldn't open up the door. So they're working on the other guy who was injured. And suddenly I came to after 20 minutes. And it was almost like they were freaked out. I came to, first thing I noticed is my mala with Osho's picture on it, and I said, well, at least that's not broken. And I looked around, and it seemed to be okay. I laughed, I giggled at the pedals of the car, which had been twisted into a bow tie, which was interesting.
Geez. Wow.
The drive shaft was bent. Most of the force of the crash hit the dashboard, which was an accordion, and fortunately, so I didn't get that. But I also wear my seatbelt. Very good thing to do, because the only thing that I hit was my side of my head into the window at 55 miles an hour as a reaction to the force.
I've done that, too.
I've only had a slight concussion.
Wow.
So anyway, I hear this tap, 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 and there's this guy with a grip of life thing and this other paramedic, and they got the big vice grips to tear me out like a can, and this guy goes, can you get out? And I very calmly said, yeah. Of course, I had been in another place. I had been given the choice to come back, and that's a whole other story that I can tell. But I opened the door and stepped out in my kurta, you know, all maroon with my mala and a red stocking cap, and I walk out, and like people just backed off and just like, oh my God, you know, Indian looking guy coming out of this. Of walking into this pool of gas, and here comes across the road, splashing away, was this man with suspenders trying to hold this huge belly. He looked like a walrus, and he suddenly ran up, and just shows you how shocked the paramedics were. He ran up and grabbed me up and scooped me up in his big arms and said, "Oh man, brother, it's so lucky that you're alive," and he started running his hands up and down, hand up and down my mouth, and said, "Them sure good beads." I said, "Yeah, they are." And then I turned to the paramedics and saying, "Look, I'm missing some time, and I feel a slight pain in the top of my head. I think I have a concussion. I think you ought to take me into the hospital for observation." And suddenly they snapped out of the jaw dropping look and said, "Oh yeah, right. Let's go.
Hop right in."
But the thing that is important about this shocking experience was that I never felt quite in my body since that experience has happened. I feel like I truly now have eyes behind my head, and that I'm not completely in the body. And I wrote Osho about it, and he basically explained to me that a lot of my past had been severed, past momentum, past karmas had been severed by that.
Mm-hmm.
The proof of that will be how I live the rest of my life. Mm. But it was... I've never been the same. And I remember many years later when I came back to India and sat down, there was a person asking a question who had a similar experience that I had had, and they were saying how they didn't feel in their body anymore, and it really upset them, and they felt unsettled. And I just started smiling because I thought, well, and then this is actually a blessing. And then I hear Osho say to the person, dress them by their name, it says, "You are blessed.
Mm.
This is a very good thing." Shocks can be, in the spiritual path, very, very good things. That is why crisis-filled times, like the times we are in, which were the subject of my book, Predictions for 2011, are it depends on how you take them. They can be blessings if you are here to grow. If you're here to stay asleep, it'll be a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
But you have, all of you, the alchemy to change any situation into something good or growing if you choose. And what helps that happen is meditation, the practice of self-observation. That, at least, is my experience, is what really helps one find one's lost innocent intelligence. I mean, Osho used to say that you're born intelligent. You're blessed and born as a birthright of Buddha. But when you're born into this world, which is the world of the ego and personality, and which means persona, which is Latin for mask, you are trained to be stupid. And stupidity is all borrowed. You don't come stupid. So,
well, in addition to that, some say that we're in the Kali Yuga, or the Iron Age, and many believe that we're intentionally dumbed down. In many ways, even if it's not intentional, there's cell phones, iPods, television, chemtrails, fluoride, aspartame, and so on and so forth. So not only do we have to awaken through our own ignorance, but then we've got this additional interference pattern, these additional interference waves that are, providing challenges for awakening.
Well, in fact, I coined it I wrote a book called Nostradamus and the Antichrist, codenamed Mabas, which looked at Nostradamus' unique take on the Antichrist prophecies. Mm. He had three of them, not one. And the third and final one is Living in Our Times. And I go through this book. It's an e-book that you can download from HogueProphecy.com.
Okay.
And it is I go through all... This is a 25-year detective trail to find evidence of which candidates could be the candidates. And the prophecies are very specific about what are the steps. And one of the strange things about it is that the most important step is that you've got to be dead. That in the case of the third Antichrist, he dies at the beginning. And it's his death that sets in motion either 25 or 27-year war of the third Antichrist. So we have four candidates. There are a lot of candidates in this book. It's a 77,000-word book. There's a lot to talk about this one facet of Nostradamus' prophecies. And in it, there are four main candidates that I get down to that are, at the time of the publication of this book and are speaking, would be Saddam Hussein, George W. Bush, Osama bin Laden, or President Barack Obama. And you know, in my effort to thoroughly upset every spectrum of political persuasion, I love it. I know I'm doing my job right when a liberal will write and say, "You bad person for saying this and that," followed by a right wing person saying, "You bad person for saying this." I go, "I know I'm doing my job because I'm neither a left wing or right wing. I'm free wing." I'm
You're
a meditator.
Equally offensive to everybody.
and meditators are equally offensive to everybody who is trying to live their lives either black or white, up or down, this or that. Because meditation is about looking beyond all that, seeing that that's a veil across the real truth of things. Moralities that people follow are veils. There is a trans-morality that even Nietzsche grasped upon it, the beyond good and evil. Is one of his great aphorisms. Very misunderstood philosopher. And only the best and the greatest thinkers and mystics can be so badly misunderstood. So
they get twisted around by polarized or dualistic thought forms.
Well, people take a little of this and a little of that.
Right.
Most people, when they listen or read anything, they are not actually reading. They are projecting, seeking things that unconsciously support their projections. And then they get angry with you when you can't be crammed up their projections. I'm dealing with a person today who, you know, was telling me how I should respond to a question, and when my response didn't come, they're all upset that I didn't live up to, you know, blah blah blah, and this is just a monkey mind in us talking, and I'm not, and if somebody takes that personally, that's not even their truth taking it personally. Your truth can't be harmed or upset by anything. Only the monkey, only the thing that's false in you can get upset by what people say.
Precisely.
Because there's always a grain of truth in what they say when they criticize you.
Yeah.
And that is, again, coming back to the issue of the two sides of prophecy. It's prophecies that predict the future, which is what I do, but I also try to go deeper into the core of why we're predictable. That is to be addressed and understood so that we can have the higher form or deeper form of the word prophecy, which is divine inspiration, awakening.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, which brings me to the year 2011, which every year, you know, I do my almanacs, these PDF file books for each year. I've been doing them on the website since 2005, but as history became more and more interesting and chock full of stuff to talk about each year, I've now graduated into writing entire books for each year.
Wow.
And you know, we are living in a year. What I do is I sign them off. I date and document all the predictions and sign them off, and then I make that noted into the book so everybody knows that whatever's in this book was signed off and sealed on the year on the date of the 21st of December. And so everything from that solstice to the next solstice is the story of the next 12 months. And the definition of this year that we're in is a year of it's almost, I opened the book, as you've read, talking about the Norns, the ancient Nordic prophets.
Yeah, that was a cool part in your predictions.
Because they're tangling, they weave the rope of the future and pass it. The oldest sisters, the past, The middle sister is the present, and the youngest sister is the future. And they are the three daughters of Erda, the German goddess of the earth. And they were famously portrayed in scene one of Gerterdammerung by Richard Wagner, a friend of Nietzsche, a mentor of Nietzsche's, until he transcended him, grew out of him. But Wagner's scene with the three Norns, he uses that as a device to review the first three operas of his Ring cycle. The other Ring cycle. There's Tolkien, and then there's Wagner's Ring cycle. And they have a lot of similarities, which is lovely, but there are also a lot of dissimilarities. Okay. Wagner's Ring, in it, the three Norns end up having the rope of the destiny tangled to the point that it breaks, signifying the end of an age. And then they sink like specters back into the earth as the sun rises. And the heroes of the final drama appear, Brunhilde and Siegfried, spent the night with each other. Woo-woo.
okay.
But he had to earn it. He had to climb up a magic fire through a mountain covered in magic fire, and the magic of getting through the magic fire is you can't fear it. If you have fear, it'll burn you. And he had no fear.
Huh.
Until he met Brunhilde.
Ah.
Yes, but that's another story.
Okay.
So this year is a tangle. I've never had a year more nebulous, more a collision, an intersection of destinies demanding our attention and our actions in the present to fulfill. Which makes forecasting incredibly difficult now. But that's often what happens at the end and beginnings of ages, which we're in, is that it's the hardest thing to predict because things are open, things are fluid, things are not written in stone. In revolutionary times on the streets of Araby, it is not written in stone what's coming next. And in revolutionary times, in time itself, which we are in, it's equally like the streets, who's going to win, which destiny is going to evolve or innovate itself into our future with our actions. And this year has that going on in it. And one of the first things I wrote about, the first chapter is usually like the first issue we need to deal with, and the last chapter is always the thing that is like the overwhelming important issue that is transcends all the other issues. And the first issue was called, in chapter one, Coup d'etat by Politicorp. And basically what I did in that is to explain the cycles of Pluto's transit through Capricorn, which has not happened in 250 years. Every 250 some odd years, what you see is a revolution in politics, economy, and the class system. And, you know, back 250 years ago, you had emergent European and American middle classes that were just as young and tender and open and becoming literate and wanting more out of life as you see 250 years later in Asia, South America, Middle East, you know, hundreds of millions of people attaining a level of being well-fed, being not starving anymore, being literate, and wanting more out of life than before. Now, what usually happens when you have a middle class cycle is that the dominant class, the power class, reaches a crystallization.
Okay.
The aristocracies of Europe had reached their pinnacle around the 1760s and 70s when the last Pluto Capricorn transit began. And on the one hand, they needed the middle class to grow and increase the richness of their realm, but the middle class in its demands for more freedom and independence and taxation with representation, not the other way around, went against their power, threatened their power. So they were in this Hobson choice of they don't want to suppress too much this middle class, but if they don't suppress it, the middle class will overthrow them. And so we have this going on now where in this year the new aristocracy, Of course, what happened back then was the American Revolution, which led into the French Revolution. And from the American Revolution, modern democracy was born. And from that last transit for the next 100 years, reverberations from that rock thrown in the pond of history, the waves of other revolutions, which led all through the 19th century into the 20th, with the Communist Revolution in Russia, the Brown Revolution of the Nazis in Germany, and finally the Chinese Revolution in the mid-20th century. All of that came as a release of energy like an earthquake's waves from what happened when Pluto was in transit of Capricorn during the time of the Declaration of the American Independence and the beginning of the American Revolution, which started with a mob dumping tea and having a tea party.
Oh, interesting.
Now, that surly mob of drunken dockyard men did not, after several years, have the rule of the revolution. More level-headed minds got involved, more leadership came. But we got to remember, our revolution started as a mob action against taxation. And
right.
That triggered all the other revolutions. Now, we're 250 years later, here we are, and a new Tea Party movement's happened. Paralleling the last, it's got a lot of blowhards and a lot of people who are kind of embarrassing and you know, getting painted up, just like they did get painted up like Indians in the Boston Harbor. Now, none of those people running around with war paint ended up your founding fathers.
Wow.
Moderate-minded people ended up taking over the revolution. Now, you have now this thing going global in the year 2011. You have a Tea Party kind of rebellion, a mob rebellion, a mob revolution in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, in Yemen, in the Middle East. But I can also tell you there have been riots in China, in eastern Siberia, and it is an issue of food or what we eat or consume. Tea was the issue in the past. Food is the issue now.
And that's much more pressing.
It's much more pressing, so it is much more desperate. So the revolutions take on the colors of something more like the French Revolution rather than our more rather mild in comparison, American Revolution. I mean, the French Revolution was the kind of revolutions that happens after that, which were, you know, terrors, purges, you know, fighting in the streets, you know, very violent. It often ended with the people exhausted and wanting a dictator. You know, 10 years of the French Revolution gave you Napoleon Bonaparte, the first great fascist leader in modern European history. And the first Antichrist in Napoleon's prophecies. The second came from another violent decade of upheaval after World War I in Germany when the Weimar Republic gave power over to Adolf Hitler.
Oh, yeah.
Who was the second Antichrist. Hister, he was called. Now we live in the time of the third Antichrist, who is either destined to do his work in the Middle East or he is from the Middle East. And his code name is Mabus. Now, to get back to the candidate, remember the four candidates I put out, you know.
Yeah.
Here's the confusion Nostradamus must have, and I'm saying in that book, Nostradamus and the Antichrist, codenamed Mabus, that he was confused. Because here you got one man who's a candidate named Usama, the other named Obama.
Yeah.
You know, you have Saddam Hussein, which is Subam backwards, Mabus. It's a reverse lettering. It's very classic anagram. And actually, he's fulfilled more of the prophecies dead than the ones who are alive.
Well, that's good, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. It's good in one way. It's good in one way that Nostradamus talked about immediately after that this war would happen. Now, it's not been so immediate. That is hopeful to me. That means perhaps we're changing the future and slowing down the process. It may still come, I still hold a lot of concerns for 2015, 2016 having a major war in the Middle East over Iran. Mm. And in my book, Nostradamus, The War with Iran, which is another e-book that's at hogueprophecy.com, I talked about the prophecies that indicated that Nostradamus was quite keyed into that potential danger, and that if it didn't happen, I wrote that book in early 2007, and I said if it didn't happen by the end of 2007, and by no later than 2009, then the astrological computations that Nostradamus used would close the aperture of the window of danger until the middle of the next decade, 2015, 2016, when those same aspects come back again. And it could very well be that much of what this book was about is about something that's happening in 4 years from now. And then you look at the way the Middle East is going, and you start to, it's starting to look like it's tracking in to that possibility, especially with the other key thing that, I mean, the most important thing about this book, Predictions for 2011, is that, you know, we start with Politicorp, which is an active new aristocracy of corporate aristocracy that's trying to control the world.
Right.
It's, of course, it's not organized like a lot of conspiracy buffs like to think. It's very disorganized, just like the aristocracies of Europe were at war with each other. They weren't all one monolithic power over the people. And it is no different now. There are oligarchs, CE oligarchs, I call them, CE oligarchs of China fighting CE oligarchs of America, fighting CE oligarchs of the EU, of Russia. These are the new great houses, if you will, of CE oligarchy. And you have these emergent middle classes. And they're going to demand what we demanded 250 years ago. And there will be revolutions and civil wars and things that will come we're in the first stages of this, where the aristocracies want to push it down. But what will happen is the people will push back. The danger is that they push back in leaderless revolutions of the mob. In this case, that would be like the Tea Party never got its founding fathers and still wore the war paint and started running around trashing things. That is the danger that we have now, that there is no leadership in any of the rebellions and revolutions that are happening. But I'm hopeful that, as prophecy tends to be predictable, because people tend to fuel that by their conditioning rather than their enlightenment that they came with, that's buried under a code of personality. And that's why meditation is there, to help uncoach you from that so that you can break free of being predictable. Because of that, people follow certain patterns. And a good prophecy scholar has a sense, an instinct in how the patterns are repeated. And a meditator sees those patterns in their own life. And when you see deeply these patterns in your own life, you instantly see them in everyone else, because we're all interconnected in our collective unconsciousness. So this force, to get back to something you were saying about 20 minutes ago about the, you know, that there's a force that the Kali Yuga, the Age of Iron, and all seems to be pushing down on us. Right. I call that phenomenon, at the end of the book on the Third Antichrist, I make a 180-degree turn. I say, you know what, this is all fantastic, but Nostradamus is barking up the wrong tree. He has understandably fixated on the personification of evil at the cost of not seeing the thing that is right in front of him and in front of everyone. And I call it, the Antichrist unconscious. It is that thing in us which we have been forced to adopt since our birth, which turns us into egocentric, personalized personalities, borrowing identities, I'm born here, so I call myself an American. I call myself John Hogue. If you say certain things a certain way, I will have a button that will be pushed, and I will respond Pavlovianly in a certain way. You burn my flag, I get it violent. If you burn somebody else's flag, I don't care. In fact, I might applaud it if it's the flag I am programmed not to like.
Right.
Yeah. all mechanical behavior. And you, as a Gurdjieffian, understand how Gurdjieff is one of the great purveyors, prophet of calling it straight and calling it down to earth and calling a spade a frigging spade, when it comes to the ego.
Yep.
And Gurdjieff used to say, and I think it was more a challenge, here to give you an example of two very interesting masters, Gurdjieff and Osho are polar opposites, so in a lot of ways they attract. I mean, when I took sannyas way back when I did that in 1980, the first thing I did the following morning was buy Meetings with Remarkable Men.
Oh, wow. One of my favorite books.
Yeah, I always found that Gurdjieff was a way, because of he was opposite to my own master. I mean, Gurdjieff's about work. Osho was about let go. Their teaching qualities were very different, but not really. And here's how I can explain that. I mean, it was more how they taught us, but they were coming from the same room with two opposite doors to enter that same room of mystery. Gurdjieff used to say that people don't have a soul, that they have to, through their awareness and their practice of the work of becoming less mechanical, of remembering themselves every moment, create in themselves a soul, and that is what incarnates. That the vast majority of people that you see all around you have no soul. They think, they dream, they mentalize that they do. They go to church. They can be popes, they can be great religious theologians and all, but they're all basically soulless, because there is a certain thing one must do to create soul. It's a commodity. It's a thing that you, consciousness is something that you feed, that you create. Mm-hmm. Now, Osho's approach was interestingly different and the same. He would say, you have a soul, but if you don't give it the right water, the right awareness, the right attention, the right climate for its growth, it remains a seed. Oh. And a seed can last forever, but it's dead until it sprouts.
Yeah.
It can have all the potentials contained of the great oak in it, but if it's not nourished, and life after life, it just goes in and out, without water, it can last for eons and be dead. So he's saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But he's saying you have a soul, but it's a seed. Gurdjieff is saying you don't have a soul, you have to earn it. But they're really saying the same thing.
That's how
two very different masters, two very different approaches, can actually be giving you a dimension of the same thing.
Yes. Yep.
Well, my goodness, have I had a rant?
Well, it's been a great one so far, and it's going to take us almost to the end of the hour pretty soon.
I should probably say something about the book.
Hurry.
Well, the most important. Yeah, there you go. Step right up and hear what's going on in 2011. Well, a couple quick predictions. Certainly, we're seeing the Donnybrook that's about to happen on the floors of Congress, which I had a whole chapter about called Watsington, D.C. And I said in the book that probably all this kumbaya stuff after the midterm elections would, everybody's trying to be very civil, but the doo-doo is going to hit the fan by April at the latest.
Uh-huh.
And I would say that that's gearing up to happen.
Okay.
The other important thing to understand is that the end of my prediction for 2010, I talked about how Mother Nature is declaring war on our abuse of her ecological balance, and I then detailed almost 100% what was going to happen in the year 2010.
Okay.
But I said this was a two-year hit, and I warned, and I warn again in the prediction for 2011, that if we don't heed the warning of Mother Nature, that she's having her blizzard cold chills, she's having her feverish summers in record-breaking climates, climate temperatures, if we don't listen to that, she will redouble. All the things you saw in 2010 will be up 50% in 2011.
Okay.
And so the other thing to be aware of is I've been pretty accurate on hurricane seasons in the Gulf. I said there wouldn't be anything going on in the Gulf for 2010. But I say in 2011 that you're going to see a reprise of the 2005 season, okay, where Katrina and Ivan and a lot of those happened. But they, whatever was keeping all the storms boiling out in the Atlantic, they're all coming in for a visit in the Gulf States area for 2011. Unfortunately, okay, I have to say that. Droughts in the southeast, that's happening. There's fires. Strange thing about this, you can have hurricanes that can cause great floods and damages at a time when the southeast gets hit by hurricanes has fires. The creeping crawl of major earthquakes coming up the eastern side of the Pacific Rim is ongoing, It will continue to walk up the Chilean coast into Central America, into Southern California, and also Washington State, where I live in. I expect that Washington State will have a between 5 and 6 magnitude earthquake in western Washington this year.
Okay.
I don't know exactly when yet, but follow the moon cycles. It usually happens in full moons, days before or 5 days after.
Right, right.
So,
and what about the global financial system?
In 2010, for years now, I've been forecasting this recession, that it would happen, in predictions for 2008, which I wrote in 2007. I forecasted the recession. And I said in that prediction, and evolved it in predictions for 2009, 2010, that if we have a two-year probation, where if we don't fix the bank reforms, we don't have the bank reforms, we don't have the Wall Street reforms, and the European banking reforms, if we kind of go on with business as usual, starting in October of 2010 and throughout the first half of this year to the middle of 2011, the aperture opens up for another major economic crisis. This crisis, I found it very odd that my oracle, which I use for this, said something that kind of went against the grain for me. It's not going to come from the usual sources. It's going to be over the price of oil. Now, I talked about the price of oil going past $100 a barrel and rising as soon as October 2010. But the thing about predicting dates, things, because there's free will, things can be delayed, things can be erased if we do the right things.
Right.
But read the book, folks. And you'll get the rest of it.
that's been a fast hour, I'll tell you. You'll have to come back, and we'll talk some more about all of this. And just to let us everybody, well, you've let everybody know what the website is. It's HogueProphecy.com. I think everybody should get your ebook and find out what we're talking about.
Okay, and you've got a link on your pages,
yes,
so people can go through there and check me out.
Absolutely. And, John, it's been a great hour. I want to thank you again for being here, coming back after so long, and we'll have to do this again soon.
Yes, hopefully soon.
Okay.
Thanks, Lance.
All right. Good night.
Good night.